Good afternoon and welcome to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg and we are live for an hour each weekday afternoon and taking phone calls from people just like you who are listening to the program and who have unanswered questions in their minds about the Bible or about the Christian faith and who would like to have somebody discuss those with them. Maybe get an answer to their questions. If you've got a question along those lines, you can call me here. If you have a different viewpoint from the host, you can call about that as well. We can talk about the differences. That's okay. Christians are allowed to have different opinions from each other. There's freedom in genuine Christianity. I know some denominations don't allow much disagreement, but that's just not the way God made things. God made people to be thinking people, to think for themselves and to sort things out and to have, reach their own conscience decisions from what God has said. And of course, we don't all understand it the same. So we reach different conclusions about some issues. And you're welcome to call and discuss any of those things that might be such a difference of opinion that you might have with the host. Our first caller today is Arnold, who's calling from Sacramento, California. Arnold, welcome to the Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Steve. Thank you for taking my call. My question is, how do you interpret the Psalms and apply it to your life? Not just Psalms, actually, but the epistles as well. How do you interpret it? How do you apply it to your life? When I read it, it's just the Psalms. Just different things that it talks about, like David, for example, talking about his enemies, for the Lord to destroy them, to kill them. How do you apply some of the Psalms to your life reading them? They are poetry, so they're a little different from the other scripture.
That's true.
Yeah, if you could answer that for me, thank you. I'll take my call off the air. Thank you very much.
Okay, Arnold, thanks for your call. Well, as you said, the Psalms are poetry, and therefore their interpretation is a little more challenging than passages that are just narrative of history or something like that that's usually written in regular prose and just straightforward statements. Poetry, by definition, uses figures of speech and flowery impressionistic images and things like that that aren't necessarily intended to be taken literally. And then, of course, Hebrew poetry also has the feature of parallelism, that what makes it recognizable as poetry in many cases is that you can see the same thought expressed twice or three times in a row in different words. That's what the Hebrews found aesthetically pleasing to the ear, to say the same thing more than one way, as well as using the imagery and so forth that is pleasing to the ear. So the Psalms and many other parts of the Old Testament are written in poetry, and we have to recognize that rather than just read them as if they were something written in a magazine article today. As far as interpreting them, we want to follow all the historic means available to us to interpret them. When David talks about his enemies, we need to remind ourselves that David was living at a time where he had various kinds of enemies, most of them political, and many of them were lying about him and so forth. And so he's praying that God will protect him from them. In some cases, he's praying that God will remove the enemies, will actually judge the enemies. Now, if these are the Psalms you're wondering about, how do you apply them? You might not, perhaps, if you don't have enemies. Not every line in Scripture will apply equally to all people. And the same is true of the epistles. You know, you read 1 Corinthians, and it's written to an actual church. All the epistles are written to actual churches or actual people and have actual settings in which they applied. And this is, in studying any part of the Bible, you need to, especially epistles or to a lesser extent poetry, it's very important to know who's writing, who they're writing to, and what was the situation that was being addressed, and what was the advice given by the apostle to the persons who were going through that situation. Once you've gotten that kind of thing squared away, then you need to ask, is there a parallel situation in our church life or our personal lives? And if so, how would Paul's or Peter's or James or John's counsel apply to us in our situation? We have to realize when we read the epistles, a lot of times we're not reading law. Like, you know, law is very rigid. Law is very inflexible and cut and dried. That's how laws are. Law books, you know, they're very much black and white. Whereas a personal letter written to somebody going through something and giving them counsel isn't quite the same thing as a law, although it may take the form of a command. That is to say, if Paul commands a church to do something as an apostle, they should heed his authority and do it. But we have to realize that all the counsel that Paul is giving is not from some kind of a law book, but is coming from, it's informed by his understanding of God's priorities, of God's principles, of God's values, of Christ's statements, and so forth. And so Paul, taking that pool of understanding of the will and mind of God, draws from it to give counsel to specific situations in the epistles. I say Paul because he wrote most of the epistles, but other apostles also did. And they you can see from reading the counsel they give, or you can deduce what the underlying assumptions are, what their values are, what they're basing that on in many cases. Now, a lot of times the specific instructions they give may not apply to a given church today in their situation, because it's not the same situation and they don't need the same counsel exactly. For example, the Corinthians were told that they ought to eat meals at home before they come to church. Well, why should they do that? Do we have to do that? That's a command in 1 Corinthians chapter 11. But you see, that was to a situation where people at communion, first of all, they took communion as a complete meal. It was a serve-yourself kind of table, and many people were serving themselves too much and leaving too little for others. And in other words, their appetite was getting the better of them, and they were leaving, some people were going home hungry, Paul said. So in a situation like that, Paul says, well, you should eat your meals at home. If you can't control your appetite, you need to make sure you are not going to be wolfing down more than your share and leaving others with too little. Now, most of our churches don't have a whole meal at communion. Most of us don't have situations where we go to communion in order to feed our appetites. But they did. And in their situation, his counsel was eat a meal at home first. Now, do I have to eat a meal at home before I go to church and take communion? Probably not, because it's not necessarily the same kind of thing. There's no communion may not be served with a meal at our church. Hunger may have very little to do with my taking communion in a modern setting. Depends on how it's done. But the point is that Paul's saying we should make sure that we are not neglecting to put others ahead of ourselves, and we should make sure we don't put our own appetites, our own interests ahead of others. And that's the principle that's informing his counsel to them. And so instead of taking the letter of the command and say, okay, everybody needs to eat a meal before they go to church, we need to understand why he said that to them and why that might apply to certain situations in our modern day, and it might not apply to some other situations. He also said a great number of times in his epistles, greet one another with a holy kiss. Well, lots of Christians I know feel that that's what we need to do because Paul said we should do it. The truth is, though, that a kiss was a normal means of greeting people in the culture, not just Christians. Everybody in the Greek world greeted one another with a kiss. Lots of people in Europe, Italians, Greeks, Russians, and so forth, do the same thing today. It's sort of like we in the West would be more inclined to shake hands or give someone a hug. It's just it's a normal greeting. And Paul, when he tells the Christians to greet one another with a holy kiss, he's writing to people who are going to greet one another with a kiss anyway, whether they're Christians or not. He's just making sure that it's a holy kiss and not some other kind. But does that mean that I need to greet everyone with a kiss? Not necessarily. Now, see, people who take a wooden literalism in applying what the epistles say would perhaps have to do that. But that's not necessarily how we're supposed to understand the epistles. We have to realize that we're reading somebody else's mail when we read the epistles, and it's addressed to the circumstances of that group. But the commands and the exhortations and the counsel in these epistles arises from an established set of beliefs and values and priorities which the apostles had, which are the core of what Christianity stands for. And therefore, from that core, specific counsel comes to specific situations. And so when you read the epistles, you need to ask yourself, well, what was the situation this was addressing? Is a similar situation, a parallel one, or maybe slightly different, but in principle similar, does that exist today in my church, in my home, in my family, in my personal life? If it does, then Paul's or Peter's or James's counsel is going to apply directly to my, to what I do. I have to do exactly what they say because it's precisely the same situation that they were informing before. If it's, we don't have the same situation, then we might ask ourselves reasonably, okay, the same principles that informed Paul, why did he say not to eat meat sacrificed to idols if it's going to stumble somebody? I don't know anybody who eats meat sacrificed to idols, so it doesn't seem to apply to me. But it may be that I live in a culture where a certain way of dressing or a certain habit like smoking or drinking might offend other people or cause them to stumble, in which case I need to realize that the principles that inform Paul's command about eating meat sacrificed to idols, even though eating meat sacrificed to idols is not an issue for me or anyone in my culture, it may apply. Those principles may apply similarly to things that we do have in our culture. So the idea of the applying the epistles, I think, is to recognize who they're written to, what the circumstance was that's being addressed, what informed the council, what principles and values and beliefs of the apostles informed their counsel, and then say, okay, how would those same principles inform counsel that God would give to me and our church in our setting? The Psalms are a little different. David was very culturally removed from me. But of course, frankly, I think when you read the Psalms and you understand what is being said in them in any given case, I think you know intuitively whether it applies to you or not. You shouldn't assume that every Psalm is going to apply to you at every moment. There are times some of the Psalms are rejoicing Psalms. Some of them are grieving Psalms. Some of them are repenting Psalms. Some of them are angry Psalms. Some of them are simply, you know, thanking God Psalms and so forth. Some of them exhort to a certain kind of behavior Psalms. Each Psalm is its own, has its own characteristics, and you would know if you're reading it whether it applies to you or not. If you're not angry, then the angry Psalms probably won't apply to you at that moment. If you're not repenting or don't need to repent, then the repenting Psalms don't. You don't have to have every verse in the Bible apply to your situation at every moment. The Bible addresses a whole range of human experiences and such. And so you got to use some common sense. Don't come to the Bible with a superstitious idea that no matter what part of the Bible you read at any given time is going to speak directly to your situation. It's better, I think, to study the Bible holistically, learn what the Bible teaches, learn what its principles are, and then you'll have that biblical information available to address situations that arise in your life. And again, there's many parts of the Bible that when I read them, I don't think they apply to me at the moment because it's talking about something else, something I'm not going through. But I do go through the whole range of human experiences, and the Psalms seem to address a great number of them. And virtually every Psalm sounds like it could be applicable to me at some time or another. Anyway, that's a short course on a large question. I can't really go much into it more. I've got to take more calls. And I just realized that I encouraged everyone to call, but I didn't give the number. We do have some calls who came through already, so I forgot that I didn't give the number. Some of our people know the number. If you don't know the number and you want to call, here's what you can call. The number is 844-484-5737. You're listening to The Narrow Path. My name is Steve Gregg. You can call in with questions about the Bible or the Christian faith, or call in to disagree with the host. But this is the number you'll need. It's 844-484-5737. And we do have some lines open right now. Teresa, welcome to The Narrow Path from Portland.
Hi, Steve. Have a couple of questions for you, and I'll need to take the answers off the air. And they're from Genesis regarding Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. The first one is, what is the sevenfold blessing or oath that was given to Abraham or that he received, and where can I find that at? And secondly, can I ask you the second one, and then I'll have to take it off the answer off here. Thank you so much. The second part of this is, Abraham was told that his seed would be as the stars of the heavens, sand of the sea, and I think also the dust of the earth. I'm a little fuzzy on that one exactly. Mm-hmm. But when you get to Isaac, when God speaks to Isaac, he says that his offspring will be like the stars of the heavens only. And when you get to Jacob, it's the sand of the seashore only. And Solomon does mention a ruling over a people that were as many as the dust of the earth. But my question about this is there something significant about Abraham getting all of it, Isaac only getting the stars, Jacob only getting the sand? And if there is, what is that significance? And I have to take your answers off the air. Thank you.
Okay, Teresa, thanks for your call. All right, you asked about the sevenfold blessing offered to Abraham. The Bible doesn't identify sevenfold blessing, although there may be seven parts that you can find of what God said to Abraham. You're not going to find the Bible referring to a sevenfold blessing, but if you asked where God's promise to Abraham is, the first time God makes a promise to Abraham on record is in Genesis 12, and it's verses 1 through 3. Usually this is called the Abrahamic covenant. And God said, get out of your country, from your family, and from your father's house to a land that I will show you. Okay, that's not a promise, that's a command. So that's the condition for this covenant. And he says, and I will make you a great nation. That's one promise. I will bless you. That's another one. I will make your name great. That makes three. And you shall be a blessing. That's four. I will bless those who bless you. I suppose that's five. And curse him who curses you would be six. And in you all the families of the earth shall be blessed. That makes seven. So in the Abrahamic covenant, you could break it down into seven specific promises. And they are stated in that number. There are that many phrases where God promised something to Abraham. So I think the passage you're looking for is Genesis 12, 1 through 3. Now, you mentioned that Abraham was told that his seed would be like the dust of the earth, or like the sand of the sea, or like the stars of heaven. But when the promise was repeated to Isaac and Jacob, it didn't give all of those different things. And you're wondering if there's some significance for the omission. I don't think there's any significance for the omission, because I think all three of those things are essentially saying the same thing. In fact, God specifically says your children will be like the sand of the seashore, innumerable. Now, that is the way in which they're like the sand of the seashore. They are innumerable. Likewise, he said the stars of the heavens cannot be counted. And he says if the stars of the heavens can be counted, so shall your seed be counted. So it's, again, they're innumerable. The dust of the earth, likewise, is with the particles of dust in the earth are innumerable. There's no suggestion here necessarily that the number of stars in the sky is the same as the number of the sand on the seashore, or that that's the same as the number of particles of dust in the earth. It's just saying that these are three examples of things that cannot be numbered. They are things that are so numerous that no one could possibly count them all up. And that's the point he's making, is simply that Abraham's offspring will be like that, innumerable. Now, the truth is, probably with modern census taken and so forth, it would have been possible to literally number the seed of Abraham, except that it's not easy to identify them. Because not only the Jews are the seed of Abraham, but also the Bible says the Christians are. Those who are of faith are the seed of Abraham, the Bible says. And therefore, and since we don't really know who all is a Christian, because not everyone who says they are really is. And also, frankly, we're not sure everyone who's really a Jew, because a lot of people have a little tiny bit of Jewish blood, but a lot more Gentile blood. So we wouldn't really know at what stage a person is regarded to be a Jew. Is it when you're half Jewish, a quarter, an eighth, and a 16th, a 32nd, a 64th Jewish? I mean, how much blood has got to be there before you can be called Jewish? So it is really impossible to give a total number, but there'd be no reason to want to. The point here is that Abraham would give rise to nations and seed that would be more numerable than people could count. Now, when he says to Isaac or to Jacob, the same thing, but he doesn't give all three examples. I don't think there is significance in the omission. Maybe he's just saving his breath a little bit, doesn't have to say the same thing three different ways to them. Besides the fact that they probably were already aware of all three of those things that God had said to Abraham, since somebody preserved that record, and it was probably them. They probably knew that Abraham had been given all three of those things. And so when God says to one of them, your children will be like the stars of the heavens or something, or like the sand of the seashore, they realize that's the same promise that was made to Abraham, because all three of the examples given to Abraham are really the same thing, at least as I understand it. They're not really making three different points. All right, let's talk to Mike from Salinas, California. Mike, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hey, thank you for taking my call. Hey, I got a question. First of all, I just kind of want to publicly say to you, I really, really appreciate your integrity, the way you run your program. And over the years, I've never, ever seen you beg for money or even any kind of manipulations or guilt or anything. And it just goes a long way. And I am going to support your ministry.
I appreciate that. Yeah, I have a conscience about that.
Yeah, you know, it goes a long way. So with that in mind, I do have a question on tithing. What is it biblically? Because sometimes it kind of seems like people are able to pull rolls out of the Old Testament and then say parts of the Old Testament don't work, but we could hold on to things of the Old Testament. And is it, I've always tithed. I believe I couldn't afford not to, personally. That was just my belief. But what is it, in your opinion, on tithing and what you believe in tithing?
Okay. Well, let me just say, I have always at least tithed.
Right.
That is to say, I've never given less than 10%. But I have seldom been willing to give so little as a tithe, because I consider that tithing is not a standard of giving that is applicable to Christians generally. It is never a command given in the New Testament. Tithing is part of law. Now, I realize some people say, no, tithing was practiced before the law, because Abraham gave 10% to Melchizedek, and Jacob promised 10% to God when he was at Bethel. Well, those two facts are true, but they don't change the point. Tithing is part of the law. We don't read that Abraham practiced tithing. We read of one case where he won a battle, and he had the spoils battle, and he gave a tenth of those spoils to the priest Melchizedek. This is not technically tithing anyway, because tithing is supposed to be done from the produce of your ground. Now, Abraham farmed and he ranched, but we don't know that he ever tithed from his produce. So there's no practice of tithing recorded in the life of Abraham, nor of Jacob. It's true, Jacob did say he'd give 10% of all his increase to God, and he probably did so once. But we don't read that he was going to do it on a weekly basis or a regular basis. I believe when he returned to Canaan after being in Paddan Aram for 20 years, I believe he did go back to Bethel and offer 10% of all the sheep and the goats and so forth that had been accumulated in Paddan Aram, and I think he did fulfill that promise. But we don't read that he kept doing similar things at any other point in his life. To point out that Abraham or Jacob, on any occasion, or one occasion each, may have given or promised God 10%, is not the same thing as saying they practiced tithing or recognized it as a principle. Someone might say, well, then why would it be 10% they gave? It was 10% in both cases. Isn't that, recognizing that, somehow they knew that was a rule? They may have known it as a standard of taxation, because the law of the region, the kings would take 10% of a person's income to support his administration. Now, Abram and Jacob didn't live under kings, but they recognized God as their king. And so when they offered him something, it may well be that they used the 10% figure, because that was standard for taxation. We know that's true, because when the Jews asked for a king, and Samuel the prophet said, well, I'll tell you how it's going to be. The king's going to take 10% of all your stuff to run his administration. And that was supposed to be viewed as oppressive taxation, by the way. And they were supposed to object, but they didn't. They took a king anyway. The point here is, though, that we don't have any record in Genesis of Abraham or Jacob or any other person prior to the law of Moses regularly seeing an obligation to give 10% of anything to God. It was included in the law of Moses because the law of Moses instituted the tabernacle worship and the Levites as the full-time attendants at the tabernacle, and they needed to be supported because they didn't have time to go out and farm and make money other ways. They were serving full-time in the ministry. So God said, well, I want all the other tribes to bring a tenth of all their increase of their crops and so forth, and bring them to the temple to feed the Levites. And so that's what it was for. Tithing was to support the tabernacle and its attendants. And it was a law that God gave that was associated with the tabernacle, continued after the temple was built, because the temple replaced the tabernacle. Well, now the temple and the tabernacle are gone. There's a new order. One greater than the temple is here, and that's Jesus. And since he's greater than the temple, we have to consider that he might have greater claims upon our stuff than the temple did. And he certainly does, because Jesus said in Luke 14:33, unless you forsake all that you have, you cannot be my disciple. He talked about people forsaking houses and lands and family and so forth for his sake. So, I mean, to him, 10% is not the standard for people to give to him. We have to forsake everything. We have to give him everything. It's a total sellout. It's a total sellout.
It could be just a starting point.
Right.
Yeah.
And so, I believe that we're supposed to be stewards of everything that God has given us. And stewardship means you invest it in the things that are of interest to the master. So
with you saying that, if I could interrupt you there, because I had a question according to that. So it's from the Christian culture, you know, where they talk of tithing in a church, which is great. I'm not going to, no qualms about that. My question would be, is it immoral if a person had a standard, okay, like to even start with 10%, but say, man, my neighbor needs food or something, that take out of the portion that I would, like the 10% that I would normally give to spread the gospel, but by seeing people in need and, you know, in certain areas of that and everyday walk of life and kind of disperse it that way? Or is it just, you know, pretty much through the overhead of the church and the preaching of the gospel and stuff like that?
We got to remember what we call the church today often is an institution that has a building and salaried clergy and things like that. Maybe a little bit like what the temple was, but that's not what the church was in the Bible. In the Bible, the church is the family of God.
Right.
And to give to the church is to give to people. The church is people. In modern times, we think of the church as an organization with leaders, and we even might even think of the leaders as the church. You know, giving to the church is giving to the leaders. But this is not at all how the Bible speaks to the church. The church is people. It's made up of living stones. All Christians are living stones built into a spiritual temple. And therefore, what is done for a Christian is done for God. Remember, Jesus said, inasmuch as you do it to the least of these, my brethren, you've done it to me. So if you have a brother or sister who's hungry or naked or in prison or in need of something, and you help them directly rather than doing the same thing for the organization that's called the church that you attend, well, you're doing that for Jesus.
Right.
And of course, there's nothing immoral about that. You don't owe any particular percentage to your church unless you have agreed to give them. Obviously, you should keep your promise. If you joined your church with the promise that you give them 10%, then you better keep your promise.
Right.
But apart from, you know, any special promises you may have made, there's no biblical reason why you should have to give your church the 10% or any percent. The Bible does say, though, that those who are ministered to in the Word should minister financially to those who minister to them in the Word. So if you're being spiritually fed in the Word of God at your church, there is something of an obligation to help out.
Absolutely. But
10% is not necessarily the figure. And if your church isn't ministering to you in the Word, then it doesn't really have any claim on your money at all. I mean, if the church has just become a career for a pastor and for a set of staff who are taking a salary, but no one's being ministered to in the Word of God, no one's being discipled, no one's being evangelized, it's just a feel-good kind of a religious club, then I don't think any money is owed to that group at all.
Okay. Well, hey, I really appreciate you answering the question. And then another thing, when you're back in Salinas, kind of let us know, like you did last time, and I missed you at the St. Ansgar's Church over there. But if you're ever over there again, I want to go over there when you're doing your business over there. So thanks a lot, and I will talk to you later. And what's the website where you're on the web? What is the
It's thenarrowpath.com.
Narrowpath. Okay. Hey, have a great day. Yep. I appreciate it.
Sure, Mike. Make sure you include the word the. TheNarrowPath.com. Okay, Mike, good talking to you. Thanks for your call. All right, let's talk to Owen from Portland, Oregon next. Owen, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hey, Steve, thanks for having me on the air, man. I really appreciate it. And really appreciate your show and answering all of our questions, man. So I have a question in regards to marriage and kind of the definitions therein. And a little bit of the backstory on why I have this question is my wife and I have been discussing this a lot with our a close friend of ours who got engaged several months ago, and he went to school to a Bible school for a year to do a program, and then when he came back, he was wearing the wedding ring, and I saw his fiance there wearing hers as well. And I had lunch with him and kind of asked, you know, did you guys get married? And, you know, he kind of gave this explanation as though, well, if they had not gone to get, like, a marriage certificate, there was no formal ceremony. And so his answer was, we're married under God. And I was trying to just ask questions like, what do you mean by that? Like, what exactly does that mean? And apparently they had, you know, this time together where they made, you know, a special vow just to each other. There was no one else. And he said that that's where they consummated their marriage a month ago. And so obviously this raised red flags for me. So I just wanted to know, the question I have for you, Steve, because, you know, we were trying to talk about this, and I was trying to explain why I believe that he wasn't married in the eyes of God, is when does it actually become, quote-unquote, official and legitimate in God's eyes? He tried to use a desert island scenario, and he also tried to use Genesis 24, where Isaac marries
Rebecca, and what took her into his tent.
So can you help me with that?
Okay, first of all, the desert island scenario doesn't seem to apply unless he's living on a desert island and this girl's the only other person there. I don't know that, if you're living on a desert island and you're single and there's a lady there and she's single and she's otherwise available for marriage and there's no one there to marry you, I believe that you could probably, especially if there's not any hope of being rescued, I believe you could probably make vows to each other before God, and that would be fine. That's not the situation anyone listening to this program is in, nor your friend either. He did bring up Isaac taking Rebekah into his mother's tent. This simply means that after he had married her, he took her into the tent. Now, what was involved in a marriage in biblical times would differ from culture to culture. They would not do exactly what we do in a marriage ceremony, and they would not, even in one culture to another, they wouldn't always do the same thing. In Abraham's day, in Isaac's day, we know this from Babylonian records, and they were from Babylonian extraction. And in the current Babylonian culture, a man would marry a wife by agreeing with her family and agreeing with her to do so, and the ceremony would be he would say, you are my wife, and she would say, you are my husband, and that was it. There were no elaborate vows, but it was something that was done with community recognition, especially the recognition of the parents. It was very important in Old Testament times that the parents be allowed to approve of the marriage, to give the daughter away and to give the son away. That's why Abraham, when he was looking for a wife for Isaac, went and sent his servant to negotiate a deal with Rebekah's parents to get their approval and pay them some fees, a bride price, and so forth. Because that's what was done. It was the parents who had the final say. Now, some people think that's very unromantic and think, well, we wouldn't want to see that happen today. Well, I think people are imagining a situation where parents just go off, arrange a marriage for their kids, and the kids have no say about it. That's not necessarily how it was. When the parents of Rebekah decided they were willing to let her marry Isaac, they asked her. They let her make the final decision. And so if she didn't want to go, she didn't have to. And likewise, you know, just because parents are in the loop doesn't mean that the boy and the girl getting married don't have the right to marry someone they love and to not marry someone they don't love. The marriage parties can actually have something to say about it, but the parents simply had, I think, a veto power. The parents... I don't think it was very common, at least. I don't think for the parents to make their children marry someone they didn't want to marry. But it was probably fairly common for them to forbid marriage to someone they didn't think was suited for them. And that's simply parents protecting the interests of their family and of their children. Now, our families have deteriorated for several generations in this society, so we don't have parents as intimately involved, although I think it's a better thing to do, especially if the parents are Christians and are in the community and know each other and so forth. In those days, people grew up in the same community for generations. So all the families knew each other in the village. And if one boy wanted to marry a girl, he'd go to the parents, and her parents knew his parents and knew each other. They were all friends, and they knew their reputation. They knew their character. And they would know whether that was a good match or not. And the parents had the right to say yes or no. I think the parental approval is the main factor in a marriage. At least in the Old Testament it was. Now, in the New Testament, we have no information given about how marriages were conducted. Some of the parts of the New Testament were written to the Jewish world. Some were written to the Roman world. Some to the Greek world. And I imagine that the ways marriages were contracted were slightly different in each of these cultures. But I imagine they also followed the normal procedures of their culture. There's no suggestion that the Christians had a unique way of getting married that was different than the culture around them, though they would have every right to, since it could vary from culture to culture. It makes it very clear there's no particular ceremony that is absolute in the sight of God that everyone has to follow. The two things I think that are, maybe three things even, would be intimate parts or indispensable parts of marriage in the Bible would be, two things would be indispensable. One would be that the couple makes a vow. They make a promise to be with each other or to be married to each other, which implies for life. Then, of course, they consummate with the sexual union and then live together. Those are the things that really make a marriage a marriage. I would say there's another element that is very desirable, as I mentioned, I think parental approval. There may be times when parents are so disengaged from their children that their approval is not even something they care about even considering. That is, neither the parents nor the children care. Very different in our culture than back then. But I think parental approval is a very important thing, if it can be gotten from parents who are, in fact, engaged with their children. Then, of course, a vow, as I said, and a physical consummation and living together. Those are the things that make people married. Now, your friend may say, we made a vow and we consummated, we lived together, so we're married. Well, that may be true. That may be true. And one cannot find a biblical verse that requires them to do something more. There's nothing in the Bible that says you have to get a marriage certificate from the courthouse. I don't even know if they had such things in the Roman world. They might have, but there's nothing in the Bible that makes that part of being married, certainly not in the Old Testament. But there are other considerations. It's one thing to say there's no Bible verse that forbids such and such. It's another thing to say it's very foolish to neglect such and such. Now, the such and such I think is very foolish to neglect. I don't see any reason for a Christian to neglect it, unless he's on a desert island, like your friend speculated about. On a desert island, I think you could neglect this part. But if you're not on a desert island, I think it's very foolish not to involve the families and the social group that the couple belong to. That is to say, to just go off into a bedroom and say, you know, do you want to sleep together? Yeah, okay, let's make vows together now and we'll jump in bed. That's not normative, because marriage forms a new social unit in whatever society the couple lives in. Now, it involves the parents and all friends, because from the point of marriage on, the parents and all the friends are going to have to relate to this couple differently. Not as two individuals, but as one. There's going to be children coming into the family. The parents of the bride and the groom are going to have legitimate emotional attachment to those grandchildren. If the marriage is ill entered and the parents disagree with it, but the kids marry anyway and it's a big mistake and the marriage breaks up, the grandparents of the children and so forth suffer heartbreak and so forth. This is marriage is not just between two people. Marriage is between two people, God, and the rest of the society that they belong to. Now, a Christian belongs to not only their biological families, it also belongs to the body of Christ and to some particular group of Christian friends that make up the community of Christians therein. And as I said, the Bible doesn't say they have to have a public ceremony, and it certainly doesn't say they have to have a ceremony authorized by a courthouse. I believe that the Bible knows of no situation in which two people were married, and I don't think the Bible would have necessarily approved of any situation where two people were married and it was not something that involved their families and their friends, and if in the New Testament, in the church also. Now, whether it involves the government as well is probably optional. I think lots of Christians now are thinking the government doesn't know much about marriage, and I would agree with them on that. And they think, well, the government, you know, will marry same-sex couples. The government will divorce people for no cause. The government has no competence even to know what marriage is anymore. So why should we care what they authorize or what they annul? The government, there may be value in getting your marriage legal. Mine is, for example, but I wouldn't have cared if it was or not. But I think in some ways, a legal marriage may protect the interests of the woman. Or maybe it needs to protect the interests of the man nowadays, too. But it's not part of the moral obligation. Being married by a court, that is having a courtroom give you a license of marriage, is not a moral thing. It may be, in some societies, required, but not in ours. Obviously, people can live together in our society without marriage, so there's no law of the land violated. If, let's say, the church marries some of the couples in them, they don't get a marriage license from the court, but the court doesn't matter. They don't care if you live together unmarried. As far as the court's concerned, you're not married, but you can still live together. You're not breaking any laws. But a marriage that takes place without the public accountability of the church and the family of the couple is lacking something very, very important. I'm not going to say it's immoral or invalid. I'm just saying it's a very foolish thing. For one thing, there's reasons why legal marriages require witnesses. Because a vow that is taken privately between two parties can be broken by one with some impunity because no one else heard them say it. If a person feels like they made a mistake or they want out or they're just not honest people, they can say, I want out of this marriage. And you say I vowed, but I'm not sure I did. You know, I don't remember making that vow or whatever. You know what I mean? If there's no witnesses, there's no accountability. That's why I think marriage as a social institution, I mean, it's a godly, sacred one, but as a social factor, it should be witnessed socially. I don't think that a private marriage with just two people is anything that the Bible would recognize as normative. Like I said, a desert island, maybe, but not in a society where people have family, friends, and Christian brothers and sisters who should be involved, who are affected by a marriage, should be allowed to give their counsel, should be allowed to be keep the couple accountable. Therefore, what I'm saying to you is this. The Bible places a very, very minimal number of demands upon marriage. But there are other, I guess, factors in marriage that the Bible takes for granted. Perhaps it would have commanded them if there was any thought that anyone would neglect them. But in biblical times, it was understood. Marriage is a social thing. The parents are involved. Among Christians, the church is involved. Society is concerned with it. And therefore, I don't think the idea of a private marriage ever crossed anyone's mind in the ancient world. Because people weren't so individualistic and so narcissistic as they are in our society. We just think it's just about me and my and her, we don't care what anyone else thinks. Well, that's because we're narcissistic, individualistic people. Other societies were smarter than we are. And therefore, I would say that to neglect the public aspect of your taking your vows before witnesses and getting the approval of the church and your family, to neglect that is a very, very foolish thing. It may not be sinful, but we don't know because the Bible didn't address things that no one had considered before. It regulated things where there might be controversy, like whether divorce was okay in certain situations or not. But in a society where no one had ever dreamed of people taking private vows and being married, there wouldn't be any reason for the Bible to, you know, mention it. So your friend may in fact be married in the sight of God. I think he did a foolish thing if he did it very privately. I think that's very foolish. And even if it's not sinful, Christians are supposed to not be foolish. And I think that anyone who's planning to get married should definitely involve their parents, if that's possible, unless their parents are just evil people who don't want to have anything to do with godliness. And should involve the church community they're in. And it doesn't necessarily have to have a wedding license from the state, but I would even recommend that unless people have convictions against it. And they have every right to have convictions against it if they wish. Just everything that would remove reproach. That's a very important thing. You want your marriage to be pure in the sight of everybody. Now, you know, if you don't get a wedding license, maybe it's okay with God. Maybe it's even okay with the church. But it may not be okay with your neighbors. I mean, certainly most of them wouldn't care, but there are people who will look at you as shacked up even though you may say, well, I made vows to God. Well, they don't know about that or care about that. So I would say you would want to avoid reproach any way you can. And I think someone who does something so unconventional as to simply take vows privately and say, okay, we're married now, is neglecting that very important factor, I think, of the social involvement. I appreciate your call. We're going to try to get some more calls in here before we're done. Chris from Sacramento is next. Chris, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, hi, Steve. Thanks for taking my call again. So I'm still talking with my friend about, you know, amillennialism and premillennial. And we were in this discussion today that involved the question of the tribulation, and it kind of floored me. I didn't know, I couldn't really understand his position because I was explaining, you know, my view on the amillennialism, and then he asked me how I could possibly imagine the tribulation fitting in that time period over that, you know, same piece of history. And have you got anything on this as far as, you know, kind of a thought? I mean, I didn't see it as a problem. He's just stopped the conversation. I can't go past this. And it's just a stopping block for him.
Okay, so your friend can't imagine how the tribulation could be fit within the 1,000 years. Is that what he's saying?
Exactly.
Okay. Well, there's a couple of things that he may be thinking differently than I would as an amillennialist. That is, he may not be seeing it the same way I would. One thing is, if he's seeing a tribulation that's coming in the future, that fits very definitely into Revelation 20, because at the end of the 1,000 years, Satan is loosed for a little while, and he goes out to deceive the nations and to bring them against the church. So that would certainly be something that could be likened to the tribulation. I mean, if somebody felt there's a future tribulation at the end of the world, this release of Satan for a little while at the end of the 1,000 years would be a perfect complement to that idea. Okay, and I will say this, that before I believed what I do about the tribulation, when I had become amillennialist, I was not yet a preterist, and therefore I figured that the 7-year tribulation that I thought the Bible taught about and that I thought was future, I figured it was the same as that little while at the end of the 1,000 years where Satan is loosed and makes trouble. That would be a good time for the tribulation. So that would be one thing. It certainly would fit. That is, a future tribulation could be fit into the paradigm of Revelation 20, even if the 1,000 years is the church age. However, I believe the tribulation that the Bible speaks about is something that happened in the past. Jesus said it would happen in his generation. He made it very clear that that would be the case. He said in Matthew 24:21, then shall there be great tribulation, such as was not since the world began, nor ever shall be. And then a few verses later, he says, and this generation will not pass before all these things are fulfilled. So I think the tribulation Jesus spoke about happened within that generation. Now, did that happen within the 1,000 years? In my opinion, it did. But why would that be in conflict with Satan being bound? There's been lots of wars. There's been lots of tribulations on people. In fact, Jesus said, in this world, we will have tribulation. So, I mean, the tribulation that came on the Jews in A.D. 70 is, I think, the one Jesus was talking about. But it's not something that was specially inspired by the devil more than other things. I think it was a judgment of God upon them. At least Jesus always spoke about it as a judgment from God on those who had rejected him. And so did the apostles when they spoke about it. So I'm, you know, God still judges and God still rules. There's still spiritual warfare. The devil still tempts people. All these things happen during the 1,000 years. The binding of Satan in the amillennial scheme is not an absolute binding that means the devil is like out of the picture. I realize the binding of the dragon and the pit and so forth sounds like he's totally out of the picture. But then if you take it literally, it sounds like he's a reptile also, but he's not. It sounds like he's got a literal chain on him of steel. But, of course, you can't bind Satan with a chain. So, I mean, these are figures of speech. This is an imagery of a vision that corresponds to something spiritual. And what it corresponds to, as it says, is that the nations or the Gentile world would no longer be under Satan's dominion and his deception. He had deceived all the Gentiles for all of history until Jesus sent his disciples out to make disciples of all nations. And now Satan cannot keep the nations in deception as he once did. And that's what is said to be the effect of his being bound. And Jesus, of course, had spoken about him being bound. The strong man was bound and Jesus was plundering his house. So The binding of Satan is something that Jesus identifies with what he had done at his first coming. But that doesn't mean Satan didn't do anything else. It just meant it's a figure of speech that he was bound. Just like if you called me and said, man, I'm trapped for cash. I really need $1,000 right now. Can you help me out? And I said, wow, I have $1,000, but I owe it to my landlord tomorrow. I have to pay my rent with it. My hands are tied. I can't help you. Well, my hands aren't literally tied, but it's just a way of saying I'm unable to respond to the situation here. And so also, Satan's hands are tied when it comes to deceiving the nations, because the gospel is going to the nations now, as it never did before the time of Christ. So the fitting in of the tribulation, I mean, I believe the tribulation is in the first century, but even if somebody wants to put it in the last century, that is the last end of the age, it still would fit with the all-millennial position to identify the tribulation with the little season at the end of the 1,000 years.
All right. Well, hey, thank you for your explanation of that, Steve. I really appreciate it.
All right. So it's no problemo.
God bless you. Have a good day.
Thanks, Chris. God bless you, too. All right. Well, let's see here. I see something's happening there. Travis from Nashville, Tennessee. Welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Steve. Thanks for taking my call. I wanted to ask you about the biblical definition of faith. I know that Hebrews chapter 1 talks about a definition, and that faith is the evidence of things not seen and the conviction or substance of things hoped for. I may have messed that up a little bit. But, our faith is entirely important in our walk and in Christianity. And, it tells us in several places the just shall live by faith. And Paul mentions, the life I live by faith in the Son of God. So faith's a big term. And I had just read a book and heard some sermons from Greg Boyd about his particular view on faith. And he'd written a book called Benefit of the Doubt, where he was introducing the idea that faith is not psychological certainty, but it is more of a conviction, or having like a conviction of things not seen, and kind of the idea that it's like a mental image of what you're believing for, although you're not having psychological certainty of obtaining it, that you're moving towards it with a conviction, believing that it will happen. And I guess what he's trying to get away from is the maybe the word of faith terminology is that, you're only as good as your faith. Like, if you just have a little bit of faith, maybe you can get saved. Or if you've got a little more faith, then, you can effect miracles. If you got a whole lot of faith, then, you can raise the dead. So it's like this faith-o-meter kind of thing. The higher your psychological certainty, the more likely you are to get results. And I think he was trying to compete with that idea and say, no, faith is not psychological certainty, but it is the conviction of seeing that thing as a substantial reality, even though it hasn't taken place yet, but you are convicted to move towards that ideal, believing it, even with having some doubt, as any one of us would have doubt.
Yeah. When Hebrews 11:1 says faith is the evidence of things hoped for, substance of things hoped for and the evidence of things not seen, I don't think that that's giving what we call a dictionary definition of faith. Lots of people say, well, that's the definition of faith. It's the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen. I don't think that's a dictionary definition of faith any more than if I say, my wife is a college professor. Well, college professor is not a definition of my wife. It's just something that she happens to be. My wife happens to be a college professor. Faith is something, and it happens to be also the evidence of things not seen and so forth. I believe faith means confidence. Faith means confidence in somebody, preferably who is trustworthy. Faith is confidence in God because you know him to be trustworthy. It doesn't mean you have confidence that a particular thing is going to happen. Faith is in a person. It's in God, and knowing that regardless what happens, God is trustworthy. And that's, unfortunately, as much as I have time to say today, we can talk about this Monday if you want to call back. I appreciate your call, but I'm out of time. You've been listening to The Narrow Path. My name is Steve Gregg. We are listener-supported. If you'd like to help us pay the bills that keep us on the air, you can go to our website, thenarrowpath.com. That's thenarrowpath.com, and see how to help us out. Have a good weekend, and let's talk again Monday. God bless.